from the campus of Stanford University.
Now, DNA contains the blueprints for how your cells live, how they grow, how they interact with other cells.
This is the future of everything.
Like a computer program, it allows the cell to perform simple computations to make decisions about when and where things happen.
With your host, Russ Altman.
Today on the future of everything, the future of herd immunity. Many of us have been thinking about vaccines, infections, fever, and herd immunity. For many, much more than usual because of the challenges of the pandemic. Herd immunity. The basic idea of herd immunity, and we're going to learn a lot more about it, but it's pretty straightforward. If enough people can gain immunity to an infection through either exposure to the infection or by a vaccine, then it can protect other people in the herd. Now, I'm going to put aside the degree to which we all feel like we're members of a herd, but let's just say that all humans are a part of the herd. And so anyone who is not vaccinated will be hopefully surrounded by immune folks, and so that these folks who are surrounded won't get the infection, even though they haven't either gotten the infection or been vaccinated. So it's kind of a fail-safe backup for the difficult-to-achieve goal of vaccinating everyone. For various reasons, both good and bad, not everyone can or wants to be vaccinated, but they can still get a measure of protection by hanging around mostly with people who are immune. This fail-safe backup fails miserably if not enough people are immune, and so there is plenty of chances to spread in your daily interactions. Or if the rate of immunity is patchy, and so if some areas have 100%, but other areas have only 40 or 30% immunity, then those second areas might be at a higher rate of infection, and it doesn't work. This is why, in fact, we're seeing continuing outbreaks of COVID in areas that may not achieve enough immunity to snuff out potential new spreading events. And there's a certain game theory element to this, where people who think they might get lucky and be part of a herd without having to get the vaccine, and we won't go there right now. Professor Julie Parsonet is a professor of medicine, epidemiology, and public health at Stanford University. She studies infectious disease, immunity, and human physiology responses to infection. Julie, we have seen many debates about herd immunity in the context of COVID and a variety of claims about what percent of the population needs to be vaccinated, et cetera. What do you make as an expert of these debates? And how should regular people think about this issue of herd immunity, if at all, and the policy implications?
I think nobody should be talking about herd immunity. I think herd immunity is something we should not be discussing. I think herd immunity is a really interesting scientific topic. It's okay. Something that modelers talk about, and epidemiologists, when they're in their basements playing on their computers, will say, okay, let's see, what would this mean? How can we model disease? What would this kind of look like? But in real life, what we really want to talk about is vaccinating as many people as possible. That's really the goal. So, you know, I like history, and just thinking about history, it took us thousands of years to get herd immunity to anything.
So there is some examples. I was going to ask you, what are the best examples of herd immunity from the past?
So let's go back to what herd immunity means, essentially. The definition of herd immunity.
Yes.
Is the definition of herd immunity is having enough people immune to the disease or not susceptible. So let's put it that way, not susceptible to the disease, so that the disease cannot be propagated in a population. It can't continue to go on. It'll get stopped because eventually each infection will run into only people who are not susceptible.
Right.
And it'll be killed, it'll just be dead. So it's not that there's no disease, it's that disease cannot be propagated. That's the main, thing about herd immunity. So the biggest thing about herd immunity is getting rid of susceptibles. That's the goal, is you have to get rid of susceptibles, and you can do it by vaccination, and you can do it, it's never been done by natural infection. So let's just put it that way. It's never been done in a real way by having people get natural infection, as far as I know.
So that's really interesting, because the whole name herd immunity kind of has this connotation that, like, in the olden days, herds of animals or herds of people did in fact get immunity because of shared infection and resistance. But that's not really, it sounds like that's not really the case.
So the term herd immunity came from cows. And so it was 1918. there was a scientist who noticed that if he separated cows that had had brucellosis, which caused epidemic abortions, from cows that did not have brucellosis, he could stop the disease. He could stop the disease from happening at all. So the cows that had calves in the brucellosis cohort, those babies, the calves would get immune at a young age. And that whole herd would stay without having any more of that problem anymore. And you just kept the other cows that didn't have brucellosis away. So the reason it's called herd immunity was because it was about cows.
Okay.
And he also realized that if you introduced a susceptible cow, then that cow would get sick. And if you introduced a sick cow to a susceptible herd, the whole herd would get sick.
Right.
But we are not herds like that. We're not separated in little paddocks. We are a globally connected community. In the human populations, herd immunity was best used for things like boys' schools. That's the first studies that were done, which were done on diphtheria, was done in a boys' public school in England, where they looked at, and they saw sort of the same sorts of things with diphtheria happening, that if you brought new boys into the school, there would be outbreaks of diphtheria. But the longer people stayed in the school, the more it would disappear. But that's a very closed environment, or in a nursing home, or on a ship, a aircraft carrier. You know, you'd see those sorts of things when you're a very closed population.
And is that where we hear about these numbers, like you need a certain percent? They looked at the boys' school and they said, if this percent of the boys or if this percent of the sailors on the ship have immunity or not susceptible, then we won't have to worry about a wide outbreak. And if anybody shows up with it, it'll tamper down the infection. Is that kind of where those numbers came from?
So the numbers come from mathematical modeling. So there's a number called R naught. R naught is the number of people that a person with infection in a completely susceptible population, so everybody is susceptible, if I got sick, how many people would I give my disease to on average?
Okay.
And so for something like measles, it's 15 or 16. And you can imagine if you had a totally susceptible population, it would go like wildfire, and it might be really hard to tamp that out because each person can give it to a lot of people. If you, for SARS, it's somewhere around 2 to 4 in that range, SARS-CoV-2, it's about in that range. So the equation is 1 minus 1 over R, and that gives you the proportion that you need to vaccinate to have herd immunity.
Okay.
So that's where that number comes from. I will say there's been herd immunity, for instance, in Hawaii. So Hawaii, when measles came in, it killed a huge proportion of the population. And then they got herd immunity and it disappeared. And then 10 years later, it came back, huge outbreak, and it disappeared, and over again. So here's one of the things about herd immunity. It only lasts as long as there are no susceptibles introduced. But children are born and they're susceptible, and people move around a lot and they may be susceptible, and vaccine immunity wanes. So measles vaccine immunity wanes, and measles immunity doesn't wane, but measles vaccine immunity wanes. Most of these things, the immunity wanes. And so herd immunity is like a constant pressure to keep doing it. You have to keep pushing.
No, this is important. And this kind of explains why the first thing you said to me is maybe we shouldn't even be talking about it, because even once you worry that once if it were achieved, people would say, okay, we've taken care of that. Now let's get back to our normal life. And what I'm hearing you say is even when you achieve it, it can be passing, because as the introduction of new babies and new immigrants and new people, then you have to readdress the question.
Yeah, exactly. You have to keep thinking about it all the time. And so the goal is to do what, for instance, we did with measles, which measles was easy. So measles is one of the really great triumphs, but measles was easy because when we introduced measles vaccine in the United States, all the adults were already immune, right? We didn't have to immunize everybody. They had seen it as children. We just had to get children. We just had to get susceptibles. That's very different for COVID, right? I mean, we have to immunize everybody because we're all susceptible. And that makes it, and measles, even measles, we still have endemic transmission of measles. We have it on occasion. If it's introduced, we've had transmission of measles in the population. because we have vaccine hesitant people. And when it's introduced into vaccine hesitant populations, we have native transmission. So herd immunity, I think, is a best a term for modelers and for figuring things out. It's not a great thing for us to push for.
So I know you, great, got it. So thank you. So I know that you have been working on many COVID-related projects. So as a physician and as an expert in these matters, what is the thing that you're spending your time on, and where is the places that we can make the most impact?
I think in terms of vaccination, one thing that we did really well is hit the elderly, get the elderly vaccinated, because those are the people who are most risk of death. So we've really done a good job decreasing the death rates by vaccinating people who are at highest risk, and totally for it. If we want to limit the disease for the long term, for a longer term, and to prevent a lot of transmission, because we still do get deaths among all those other groups, yeah, right? Then you want to get the people. So just getting back to the herd immunity, which I decided I didn't want to mention, but you know, the people you really want to vaccinate are the people who are out there and are likely to transmit. There are some people who are introverts and never go out and you don't need to vaccinate them. They're not going to transmit it. So you want to get those people who are young, like to party, have jobs that have a lot of human contact, are real extroverts. Those are the people that you get the most bang for the buck for when you do vaccination. And those are the people who are most resistant to vaccination.
Right.
That's the switch that we have to make in our thinking about it, is to say, this is a social good. This is a part of being a citizen of a democracy, getting vaccinated for the good of everybody. It's not just for your good. And I know that, you know, you're not worried for yourself, but this is a social civic responsibility that we have. And like, you know, pledging allegiance to the flag or all the other things that we do, that's part of being in a democratic society that we feel is important. And people should be willing to be vaccinated for the social good.
This is The Future of Everything. I'm Russ Altman. I'm speaking with Professor Julie Parsonet. We're talking about vaccines for COVID, herd immunity, less so, and the need to vaccinate young people. Now, I was recently reading a paper, I'm sure you're familiar with it, where they looked at the overall spread of COVID. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I read that, just as you said, young people are key for spreading, but they found that it wasn't all young people, that they seemed to find certain people, I think they said like 10% of the infected population were responsible for an outsized number of infections. Their R-naught, if I'm understanding your definition of R-naught, their personal R-naught in terms of the number of spreads, they were kind of super spreaders, I think that term has been used. That makes it especially hard, it would seem to me, is if there's going to be a few groups. Is there any attempt to try to identify these people in the way you just described, the partiers, the people who love to be around other people? Or is that really not going to work and we just have to try to get everybody? Because it seems like getting everybody is going to be hard, especially given the resistance in some populations.
Yeah, I don't know that we can find those really risky individuals. You know, I think it's really hard. And we don't know why some people are super spreaders. It's just not clear why, you know, there's one person who goes to a wedding and everybody gets sick, whereas another person who's infected may go to a wedding and nobody gets sick. And we don't know exactly why that is. We do know that there are associations between social well-being, economic well-being and transmission, and lack of vaccination, because there are populations where people live in more crowded conditions, there are more people in the household, there are multi-generational households. There's a lot of transmission in those settings. And those are settings in which, and those people often in those populations work at essential working jobs, they work in supermarkets, they do deliveries, they have a lot of contact with a lot of other people. And they have the potential to spread COVID to their families and to their local populations. So there's a lot of interest in talking about not so much herd immunity, but community immunity, right? This was a question that was raised to me actually when I gave a lecture the other day. She said, should we stop talking about it as herd immunity and start talking about it as community immunity? and I wouldn't even say immunity. I would say community protection, right?
Okay. And what would that mean?
It would mean really going towards these populations that are highest risk, working with community leaders and saying, this is why it's important. And this is how your population can protect yourself overall. You know, you want your community to be healthy. And there are lots of ways. It's not just vaccination, because if you wear a mask all the time, right? So I told you that the key to protecting a population is getting rid of susceptibles. Okay, you can do that by vaccination. That's a really clean way to get rid of susceptibles. But wearing masks get rid of susceptibles, okay? If you wear a mask, you're less susceptible. Let's say you're 30% less susceptible, 40% less susceptible. So if everybody wore a mask, 40% of susceptibles are gone in your population. You can have people stay home. Somebody who's staying home, they're not susceptible. They're not gonna get exposed. Right. So you talk to a community and say, look, these are the reasons why you combine all those things. If you're not gonna get vaccinated, that's, you know, you're not getting vaccinated, but at least you can contribute to the community susceptibles and getting rid of your community protection by doing these other things that are helpful.
Yeah, that makes sense. And also people's affinity to their community might be more strong than their overall affinities to the society in general. We are all part of multiple communities, and that kind of makes sense. I hate to almost ask this, but if these measures fail, what are we looking at? Like, so what happens if the people who are going to get vaccinated are all vaccinated now, and we just aren't successful at pushing vaccination any harder? Do the modelers address the questions about what a long tail pandemic might look like? I mean, it's hard to think about.
Yeah, they do. And a lot of it is still unknown. And the reason it's unknown is because we don't know the duration of immunity, right? If immunity just lasts 3 months, it's a very different thing than if immunity lasts like it does for measles, a lifetime.
Right.
And how many times do you have to get exposed to provide protection? Let us say that it provides significant protection for a lifetime, or that we end up having annual vaccines. So people, as they get, you know, will have multiple vaccines over a course of a lifetime. In that sort of scenario where you have really good protection, like you would have for measles, then what happens when a disease is in a population for a while is that as you get older and older, the people who survive are all immune.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
So it becomes a disease of childhood. Mm-hmm. So that's what happens when you have a disease like that. It becomes a disease of the most susceptible, which are the children. And then a few rare people who may have lost their immunity who are elderly. If it doesn't work that well, it would look like flu. Okay. Mm-hmm. So, you know, flu is, I think, a way that we may envision this happening, because there's a lot like coronavirus has a lot of similarities to flu. First, one thing that makes herd immunity, by the way, challenging is both of them infect animals. So that means you have a huge extra population of susceptibles, right?
Right.
You have all your cats or could possibly get SARS-CoV-2, and it infects minks and ferrets and deer, and they can transmit it among themselves. And so that means that you're not going to get rid of it easily from your population at all, because if they're transmitting it to each other, it can always pop up, right?
Right, right.
So that's like flu, which also infects animals. It mutates a lot, like flu does. So there's always this chance, possibility of variants. And we have a lot of resistance to flu vaccine, and there's a lot of this resistance to coronavirus vaccine. So I think—
Social resistance.
Hesitancy.
Yeah.
There's vaccine hesitancy. People think it's not a bad disease.
Oh, so that's interesting. So we have these two extremes. One is if we have long-lived immunity, it becomes a disease of children. If it's short-lived, then it becomes, if not seasonal, just recurrent, and it's always with us, and we have to just try to fight it on an annual basis.
Right, and continue to vaccinate. And fortunately for this, again, children are spared terrible illness, which is really great. Unfortunately, it still affects a lot of other people who are still going to be at risk of dying. So it may end up being like flu, where we're going to vaccinate people recurrently, and we'll have sporadic cases throughout the population, and it'll, you know, kill a certain number of people a year.
This is The Future of Everything. I'm Russ Altman. More with Dr. Julie Parsonet next on Sirius XM.
The Future of Everything with Russ Altman.
I'm an enthusiast. I'm not
Welcome
a
back
journalist.
To The Future
from
of Everything.
From the campus of Stanford University.
Dr. Julie Parsonet. And we're going to do a little switch of topics from herd immunity to temperature, human body temperature. Julie, you wrote a really fascinating paper looking at the temperature of humans over the last 100+ years. Could you tell us why you did this and what you did and what you found?
Yeah, there were a lot of reasons for it. Thanks for asking. This is one of my favorite topics. You know, I am an infectious diseases doctor, and every doctor that I know, when a patient comes in and they say, I'm sick, and we take their temperature and it's 98.6, and they say, but my temperature runs 97.5. And so this is a temperature for me. And every single doctor, we see that almost every day from multiple patients. They'll say, that's not my temperature. So I started thinking about it in two contexts. One was that, you know, that all my patients are saying this. And the second was that we're getting fatter. And temperature is a marker of your metabolic rate. And I started to think, well, maybe this is not really our fault. Maybe the fact that people are getting heavier is because their metabolic rates are slowing. And we can look at that by looking at their temperature and see if our temperature has decreased over time.
Okay.
And so those were the sort of two things that came together. And so I've been thinking about this for probably 15 years. And then I had just this great student who was working with me, Mira Protsev, who found the right cohort to look at it, and the Union Army cohort. And so that gave us an opportunity to look at what temperatures were like in the 19th century.
So you're talking Union Army as in U.S. Civil War.
U.S. Civil War, Union Army.
And they took temperatures?
So they did not take temperatures, but the veterans did. So to get their pension after the war, they took their temperatures. Oh. So we have temperatures from the 1860s into the 1920s from Union Army veterans. And so we could look back at their temperature both by the year it was taken, but also in a person based on the year they were born. So we have temperatures on people who were born in 1800. So we can kind of look and see based on the year they were born, whether their temperature was declining over time.
Okay, so that's already, you've hooked me. What did you find?
So we found that temperature is definitely declining. So our actual temperature, this 98.6, 37 degrees, was defined by
37 degrees centigrade.
So 37 degrees centigrade, 98.6 Fahrenheit, was defined by a guy, Carl Wunderlich, in 1850s. Okay. And so he took millions of temperatures. You can just imagine this guy writing this all down on a piece of paper.
Yeah, there was no Excel.
Tens of thousands of people. And he defined from that what the normal body temperature was. And lo and behold, when we looked at the Union Army, their temperature was 98.6. That was their temperature.
So good job. He did a good job.
He did a great job. And all the things he said were true, which is if you're heavier, you have a slightly higher temperature because you have to heat more body mass. If you're taller, slightly lower temperature, women higher than men, all this other stuff, all true. And then we looked in the 1960s and the temperature was lower. And then we looked at today in 600,000 temperatures at Stanford, and the temperature was lower still. So it's declining 0.03 degrees centigrade per decade, and has gone down a degree Fahrenheit over the last 100 years.
So the people who say that they run, instead of running 98.6, that they run 97.6, they might be telling the truth.
They are telling the truth, yeah. And they may especially be telling the truth by the time of day, because your temperature is always lower in the morning than it is in the evening by a considerable amount. So, you know, by half a degree. So yeah, absolutely. And the elderly have lower temperatures than young people. So they'll never get to 98.6. I mean, even their wildest dream, they're not going to get into 98.6.
And so that this is important. I think you said it in your intro. This is important because what constitutes an elevated temperature and a fever might therefore be a little bit of a sliding scale. And so when somebody who runs 97.5 comes in with 99, that actually might be clinically more significant than many doctors might have been trained.
That's absolutely true. And so especially again in the elderly who don't mount fevers very well, but it's absolutely true that temperatures are probably an abnormal temperature is probably considerably lower than people than the average physician or the average person thinks. I think all of us when we're kids, we're feeling sick. Our mom says, you're going to school unless your temperature is above this number, 99.8. You're going to school unless it's above 99.8 or above 100, you're going to school. So we're all trained to think about this number as being really, really critical in determining whether we're sick or not, right?
Yes, yes.
Rather than saying, well, I feel sick, so I am sick. You say, it has to be over 100 or I'm not sick.
You said a few things very quickly that I think we should revisit, but before we revisit those about women and men, I think people will be interested in that. And also I want to ask you about the cause of this, but what about across different ethnic groups?
The only thing that we were able to look at that we had enough people to really look at in our study were Blacks and whites, basically. Uh-huh. And they were identical.
They were identical.
I mean, their decline was identical. There was, I think, a slightly higher temperature, just minusculely higher in Blacks than whites, but it wasn't a lot.
Talk to me about the potential causes of this. I know enough about evolution to believe that this probably is not an evolutionary change in humans because there hasn't been enough generations, although you could correct me. So do we have a mechanistic reason about what's going on here?
What we found happened over 150 years, but there's another group that just recently published a paper from Bolivia that found the same drop in temperature over 16 years in a very indigenous population of rural Bolivians. So they're seeing a very rapid decline. And I think there are two reasons that we're seeing this decline in temperature. One is that we have fewer infectious diseases. And infectious diseases drive. So when Carl Wunderlich did this in the 1850s, all these people had tuberculosis. They may not have known it, but they had tuberculosis, right. And they had syphilis, and they had, you know, chronic diarrhea and osteomyelitis and all sorts of other things that were going on in these guys.
Right. So they could have appeared normal, but they actually had a low level disease that was raising their temperature.
Exactly. And they had, you know, a lot of things that happened in childhood. They may just have raised their metabolic rate because their whole lives are fighting infectious diseases, which we don't do anymore. And we actually know that inflammation is still declining since the 60s. If you look at markers of inflammation, they're lower now in humans than they are in the 1960s. So we're taking Advil, we're taking all sorts of things that people didn't do before. We're eating healthier, less inflammatory foods, not smoking, all sorts of things that decrease our inflammatory. And then the other thing is that we always live at 70 degrees. So in the 1850s, you had to work hard to maintain your temperature because it was either really cold or really hot. And when you're outside that 70 degree range, your body has to work hard to maintain your temperature. When you're always at 70 degrees, your body doesn't work. It's at ease. And so your metabolic rate doesn't have to pump itself.
That's really fascinating. And just to end real quick in the last 20 seconds, should people have a personalized understanding of their own temperature?
I think it's kind of cool to have it. It's kind of neat to know what your normal temperature is. But in my own sense is, if you feel sick, you're sick. And it doesn't really matter what the number is.
Got it. Well, thank you for listening to The Future of Everything. I'm Russ Altman. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app.
This has been The Future of Everything with Russ Altman on SiriusXM Business Radio. If you missed any of it, listen on demand, online, or with the SiriusXM app.